All right, this is David Spence for EnergyTradeOffs.com once again, and we are here today with Joshua Busby, Morgan Bazilian, and Dustin Mulvaney, who are authors of a recent piece on Yale Global Online on the energy transition. Joshua Busby is Associate Professor of Public Affairs at the LBJ School of Public Affairs here at the University of Texas. Morgan Bazilian is the director of the Payne Institute at the Colorado School of Mines and professor of public policy at the Colorado School of Mines. And Dustin Mulvaney is an associate professor of environmental studies at San Jose State University. Gentlemen, thank you for joining me today.
Thanks for having us.
We will link your piece in Yale Global Online. It's entitled Energy Transition, Coal as the Canary. And so I wanted to start with a really basic question. What was your goal? What's the takeaway message you want readers to see in this piece?
Let me start. I think the motivation initially was that the clean energy transition is likely to have dislocative effects on certain sectors, and we see that happening for other reasons in the coal sector that has been undergoing a process of declining employment for decades as a result of automation and competition from other fuel sources, and that the changes wrought by the clean energy transition that will likely accelerate in decades to come as climate concerns move forward could have consequences for communities that and sectors that are on fossil fuels for employment and taxes, and advocates for clean energy transition for ethical reasons and politically strategic reasons need to be attendant to their needs. And that's really one of the motivations for this piece. A second consideration that I wanted to draw attention to is that the longstanding conversations about the ethical considerations of a clean energy transition also have to be mindful of their communities of color and low-income communities that have disproportionately borne the burden of pollution and contamination from fossil fuel sectors and petrochemicals, and any clean energy transition also has to be mindful that those communities can't be left behind and have long unmet needs that need to be addressed as well.
Yeah, and I want to get to the particulars of that idea in a second. But before we leave your initial point, this piece that the three of you have written ties in the pandemic, which is still going on as we are speaking right now, and the effects of the pandemic. The price of oil and gas, or oil in particular, has plummeted, and that has fairly significant effects on communities and states that are dependent upon jobs and revenue from the oil and gas sector. Can you elaborate a little bit about that experience?
So, you know, as Josh described, there's several motivations for focusing on just transitions. And a part of that is that the bulk of the community that in academia or think tanks or the policy space tends to focus on the technological curves of the energy transition. In other words, what kind of technologies make up the portfolio of energy systems. And so we pull back to our technical wonky backgrounds in general. That's not the case for people like Josh, who are political scientists as much, but at least in the scientific community, that is the case. And so making sure that those technological forecasts or scenarios, which are based on physics and engineering and science, are married to the real world, as it were, and the social and economic consequences of those kind of scenarios. And so that's the overarching so we've seen a clear decline in the coal economy. That's both for coal power plants and for mining. The market has seen a downturn, and that's why we've, the first piece of this just transitions has naturally, at least in the United States, has focused on coal. That's also true in other countries like Germany and other parts of the European Union. So getting to your question, and I apologize for the long inroads to it, with the dual current challenges of the COVID pandemic, which primarily affected the oil and gas markets from a demand perspective, and the that impacted oil prices and also gas prices to a certain extent, we see some real big losses on the financial side for oil and gas. And those are essentially directly analogous to the kind of losses you saw on the coal side, which are job losses, direct job losses, and then economic multipliers or other parts of the economy that are affected by those job losses. And in some cases, the economic impacts of those losses, both in coal and in oil and gas, are larger on lost tax revenue or lost inputs into communities than they are on the job front. The job numbers get all of the attention, as is probably correct, because they directly affect people's lives. But the losses to the wider community are also significant, and you can see that in the states where oil and gas make up a large part of the economy. And so we wrote about some of these initial impacts that we saw. Say in Alaska, you have 70% of the state revenues coming from oil and gas, Wyoming 52%, North Dakota 45%, et cetera. This, in the oil and gas sector, just like in the coal sector, it is limited to a certain amount of states, say 10 states that are most impacted by this. So not all states are impacted in the same way, but there are economic, as I said, multiplier effects that go into the rest of the economy. So you could see in the upstream oil and gas sector that you could lose up to 200,000 jobs over the next 6 to 12 months. So that is pretty close to what happened in the 2015-2016 price decline in oil. So it's not unprecedented, a word that is being highly used these days for everything, for good reason. But it is significant in that this time it looks a lot less likely that we'll have to bounce back to the full demand picture.
Yeah, this is Dustin's voice. And a couple of interesting things that come to mind around this question of why coal and not oil and gas in the conversations around just transition. Why are we seeing traction in these policies? And maybe more discussion, but not the policy push in oil and gas. If you go to oil and gas industry websites, you see a lot about transition. It's very much at the front. And when you go to coal websites and power plants and things like that, you don't see that emphasis yet. In the policy discussions, we see a lot more planning and thought into what are we going to do about these workers. And the question is, why is that? And I think it has to do with the different markets and composition of the electricity industry versus oil and gas, right? The market dynamics are much more in flux, it seems, with oil and gas. You don't have the planning that you have, for example, with an electric utility who has to think about forecasts for what power plants are going to get built when on certain timelines and when are we going to retire certain things and when the certain policy gets passed that directly line items a coal plant for closure or specifies that a plant needs to be closed. Then you have an actual, tangible policy that's forcing potential job losses. So you can kind of see even the ethical question that Joshua raised earlier becomes forefronted to some extent because you actually have literal policies that are potentially eliminating jobs, where in oil and gas, it's more, there aren't policies necessarily, they're more amorphous, I think, or they're less direct policies in how they shape jobs. So there's a couple of steps and there's market dynamics and all these other things going on. So I think that's part of the reason we don't really see policies being proposed specifically with tangible outcomes yet in this place or in this space. Whereas if you go to parts of the American West, for example, where there are closures, we see much more deliberate policies in response to specific plant closures.
So in this Yale piece, you all essentially say that this raises the question of what obligations governments have to their citizens to help ease the harm or the pain associated with this kind of transition, and argue that the transition has to attend to issues of equity and justice. And you elaborate a little bit on sort of ways in which that sometimes has happened in particular places in the world, and offer a few thoughts on how we might approach that going forward. Can you explain a little bit about what the main takeaways are there?
Sure. Some of the ideas have been longstanding in advocacy circles, you know, that if there are job losses associated with clean energy transitions, whether it be coal or coal is a harbinger of what may happen in other sectors, then you need to, as Dustin said, you need to plan for that, also resource that. And that means income support, that means pension support, that means worker retraining, that means site remediation, dealing with, say, areas where there's been a lot of contamination of the groundwater or other areas. And it may mean extensive investments in infrastructure to kind of facilitate that transition for both kind of an active industrial policy, but also to kind of ensure that the job opportunities in new clean sectors do emerge and are supported. And all of those policies have a price tag. And I think one of the interesting questions is whether this effort that is on some level motivated by ethical and moral considerations is also a kind of strategic effort to build bridges and widen the coalition of support for a clean energy transition. And that starts with workers and organized labor, but also is trying to build alliances from the environmental community to communities of color with which they've not always had, this is, environmental community has often been seen kind of as a lily white movement and not as attentive to issues of environmental justice. So this coalition building effort to bring in other sources of support and maybe diminish it, potential sources of opposition is not just an ethical project, but a strategic one. On the other hand, sort of adding the price tag to a clean energy transition, if it's not simply about sort of emissions mitigation measures, but also involves all, active industrial strategy and sort of compensatory mechanisms to help communities that are affected by the clean energy transition, it raises an interesting question whether that makes it harder to achieve some of your clean energy goals. In 2019, the Congress passed a pension rescue bill for the 100,000 retired coal miners, and it authorized the U.S. Treasury to transfer as much as $750 million a year to those pension funds. And that's the kind of support policies that are substantial, that ensure that workers that are affected by an energy transition aren't left behind and aren't left impoverished and unable to meet their needs in the last years of their life.
This is Dustin, and another example of a challenge faced by communities that are dependent on these infrastructures and old energy systems that we're going to phase away. Navajo Nation is a good example, because that community has been dependent on the Navajo generating station for, depending on the years, upwards of $40 million in revenues to that community. And just losing that big piece of infrastructure, that's a lot of that's a lot of revenue loss for a community that's already, you know, doesn't have energy access for all of its community members and has all these water issues. So in some ways, it's more than just the workers. It's the communities that are dependent on these revenues and how is that going to be made up for, and what existing remnant infrastructures are still in place that could be utilized in an energy transition. So there's discussions about building out solar farms to utilize the electricity generated, or the electricity transmission infrastructure that's already connected to California. You know, keeping in mind not just the jobs aspects, but also how to backfill many of these revenues that are going to be lost to communities that are dependent on them.
In Colorado, with there's two bills. There's a Senate Bill 236 and a House Bill 1314. The Senate bill is mostly a financial bill, issuing ratepayer back bonds to secure the remaining value of the coal plants. But that some of the revenue from that can be used to aid towns. But the HB 1314 is directly related to this. And it says Colorado must ensure that the clean energy economy fulfills a moral commitment to assist the workers and communities that have powered Colorado for generations. So it's in a bill that passed. And in that, it creates this thing that Josh alluded to called the Just Transition Office within the Department of Labor, which I think is a really interesting precedent to institutionalize literally this kind of transition thinking. And there's two pillars of it, but there's benefits to workers. So that's training and wage differential stuff. And then there's community grants. So it recognizes both aspects that we have all touched on here, from the loss of jobs to the loss of revenue for communities.
Okay, so just two, let me just get your collective reaction to two things I heard. But the two points are the following. So one is that the jobs that we get in a big wind and solar build out are not as good jobs as the jobs in a nuclear power plant or a coal-fired power plant, or even in a coal mine or in the oil and gas industry, in terms of being sort of higher paying, longer duration, and there aren't as many permanent jobs. I know that solar farm builders, at least on flat surfaces, are looking into robotic construction, you know, just very little labor. And there's certainly very little labor in the way a wind farm or a solar farm or a hydro plant operates these days. They're often remotely operated. That's one criticism. And then I also see periodically, you'll see in the New York Times, some in-depth article about some sort of transition program in, say, Kentucky or West Virginia, trying to teach miners how to, like, code or something, right? And how unhappy they are with the transition program in question. And I don't know if those are anecdotes that are representative of any larger truth or not, but I, as people who have really have dived into these subjects in a much deeper way than I have, what are your insights or responses to those sorts of criticisms?
I can start on some of the job issues. On the solar power plant side, particularly the utility scale, they generally show fewer workers per megawatt than rooftop solar, which obviously is much more labor intensive. You're not putting as many solar panels out per person. There are a lot of other added jobs that are associated with all those activities. So just the on-site job numbers are not good enough to say what is the job impact here. There's all sorts of supply chains and just kind of local business things that get generated from having those economic activities. But I think the point about labor and wages is really important. We don't really see the level of unionization in a lot of the clean energy sectors. There are challenges with that, and I'm not going to go as far as to say that the unions are the panaceas here either, because they are in many ways a lot of the roadblocks to energy transition. And I think that this is a tremendously complicated political dynamic, understanding the role of unions in this situation. But I think there are some legitimate questions about transitions and fewer jobs, but that's been the story of automation. I mean, this is just the way industries develop, and you can either pay workers less or you can eliminate them, and that's kind of the one of the functions of capital in these systems.
I think a couple things we have to keep in mind in these things is one, although it sounds sort of trite to say, these are very complex systems and they have deep interconnections with other parts of the economy and our society. And if we, as I'm certainly guilty of, and probably Dustin also, we tend to look at the world from an energy lens or an energy and environment lens. And in this case, we really need to try to broaden that horizon. And so just making a one-on-one comparison between a job in a coal mine or a coal plant and a electricity control center, or putting up a wind turbine or a photovoltaic system, does not allow the system boundary to be big enough to make decent policy choices, I think. And these days, you know, without a decent level of humility on how we approach these things, we will fail. These kind of policies, they can come down to very specific things, like Josh related to us about helping people's pension funds or doing retraining. But those things done with hubris or with blinders on tend to come across to the communities who need them as patronizing.